Good morning, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, whenever you're watching this. The Future Investment Initiative just wrapped up its priority summit here in Miami Beach. I attended, so did Patrick Basham, and we will be getting into some of the very interesting issues which were raised. The future is now, a saying I've heard since I was a boy, definitely comes to mind, and you will find out why. On this episode of NewsSight, I am your host, Joseph Cotto. Patrick, it's very good to speak with you. I mean, there's so much to discuss. It's been a profoundly interesting 2 days. The Future Investment Initiative is a project of the FII Institute, and its strategic partner was the Public Wealth Fund from Saudi Arabia, although the FII today it's an institution that really, it's kind of hard to even begin to address its reach. It's something that is really coming into its own on the world stage. And I don't think that the years to come will prove any different. I see the FII playing more and more of a role within the global business community. And we'll get into some of the brass tacks of that. But Patrick, where would you like to start off this afternoon?
Well, Joseph, it's first of all, thank you for the invitation to be with you as part of your FII Miami Summit wrap up. Great to be with you. It's been, as you said, absolutely fascinating 2 days. I had the good fortune to be in Riyadh last October, which was the venue for the 7th annual sort of global Future Investment Initiative conference. And although that was many times larger in scale and scope and delegates and obviously global in all senses, these 2 days in Miami have lived up to their billing. It's obviously had a far more American/North American focus in terms of the delegates attending and the speakers involved. But it has not just touched, but delved into, you know, truly global issues. And so whether you're talking about investment or technology, a lot of attention here. There are a few speakers who didn't mention AI. And I think the second last plenary conversation was the actor and producer, now podcaster, Rob Lowe, who mentioned towards the end of his conversation with Todd Boehly, that he realized that he hadn't mentioned AI yet, and that was the first for the 2 days of this conference. And I think he was correct in that that assessment. So the issues are not just national, transnational, international, truly global. And so it's been fascinating in that sense to have experienced Riyadh, and where the delegates were global, but obviously a little far more from the Middle East and from Asia. And to see people really trying to wrap their arms around the same problems, economic problems, investment problems, financial regulation, how to cope with, harness the new technology, how to ward off the potential unintended consequences of unleashing a new technology. And then, of course, the issues that the FII is particularly interested in, such as sustainability, the blue economy, blue energy, the green economy. And what has been obvious in these 2 days, as it was in Riyadh in October, is that these events and the FII Institute, they bring a very welcome balance to the global discussion. It's a discussion which for decades has, and it, especially in the last several years, but the last decade, has been very much led by the likes of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, which is, I'm sure many of your listeners and viewers are aware, brings with it a very predictable these days of globalist, elitist, statist set of edicts where a comparatively small number of extremely wealthy and extremely powerful people from politics and business, etc., tell the rest of us what we're doing wrong, what we need to do to set it right, but don't tell us quite how much it's going to cost us. And they go about their merry way, attempting to pull as many, you know, sort of puppet strings as possible. What I find first in Riyadh, but then now here in Miami Beach, what I find so refreshing about the FII conferences and summits is that they're not a top-down affair, right? Obviously, many of the speakers are, they're all very successful people, as are many, if not most, of the delegates. But there's a greater sense that these important issues, which need to be resolved, need to be debated, discussed, that's just it. They need to be not just resolved, they can't be resolved by top-down edicts. They do have to be discussed and debated. There has to be a conversation. It's a situation where I think everybody who attends feels like they, figuratively speaking, have a seat at the table, right? They have a voice if they choose to use it. This is about developing either new prescriptions or tweaking old prescriptions on the economic front, on the technology front, on the environmental front, just to name three, but to do so in a more collegial and collaborative way. I can't say it's bottom up, but it's certainly not top down. And I think that's refreshing. And these annual conferences, the ones in Riyadh, have been going for 7 years. I think the regional summits are a newer addition to the FII sort of armory. But already, they have grown to an extent where clearly they are challenging in terms of, if not yet influence, then certainly importance, what happens in Davos, the World Economic Forum. And I would predict that before too long, as the World Economic Forum crowd becomes less and less relevant, no matter how powerful and financially strong they are, that the Future Investment Initiative Institute and its events are going to be, in the nicest possible sense, gently elbowing the World Economic Forum out of the way when it comes to producing really relevant discussions with prescriptions that can actually resonate and work in the new world, in the new economy. The emphasis here on entrepreneurialism, the emphasis on risk-taking, the emphasis on technology, the emphasis on startups, right? The recognition that business should be a force for good, right? That profits are not a bad thing. They're essential if you're going to fund, whether it's new investment in technology, new investment in environmental protection, you name it, right? It's recognizing that this isn't a good guy and bad guy, black hat, white hat, world we're in this regard. It's about recognizing what are the true economic and financial lessons of the past and applying them to new challenges. So I think it's a very optimistic event, very positive event, and you can't say that about a lot of debates and discussions that go on around the world and especially in America. I mean, there's a great deal of, I think, disagreement in an event like this. You know, the prominent folks like Larry Summers speaking, Steve Mnuchin, people who don't necessarily have identical views on economic policy, for example. But that's fine, right? It's about hearing what everyone has to say and then people drawing their own conclusions and applying the lessons that they've learned. So a fascinating couple of days. And, you know, let's hope that there are more to come because, you know, this is an institute and a series of events that are worth following, worth attending if one has the opportunity. And we have to hope that they continue to have great success.
It, It is interesting. I think I need to start off by saying that if I recall, I misidentified what the founding partner of the FII is. I think I said the Saudi Public Wealth Fund. It's Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund, which is called its Public Investment Fund. Anyway, but in case I screwed that up, just throwing that out there. Talking about what has happened here is such a multifaceted thing, to say the least, because you could take it in so many different directions. There were so many things brought up. So many people were here, just to name a few, and I do mean a few. Larry Summers, Eric Schmidt, Mike Pompeo, Steve Mnuchin, Dinah Powell, McCormick, Jared Kushner, Dr. Oz, Stephen Schwarzman, Maria Bartiromo, Sam Nazarian, Michael Dell, David Rubenstein, and Brian Grazer, among others, many others. It really was a star-studded event, and absolutely fascinating to hear all of these perspectives. As Patrick brought up, it certainly was not a one-way forum. There were people who had widely divergent views, but everything was shared in a very respectful, respectable, upbeat fashion. And that definitely is a change from the norm, considering what we so often find in the U.S. and elsewhere today. So, that just the sheer breadth of this event, which, as Patrick mentioned, is much smaller than the one in Riyadh, which I did not attend, but I did cover it from afar, from a very far. Immensely impressive, really impressive what happened here. And, there are so many issues to get into with regard to this that, right now it's boggling my mind. But I think that this is something worth bringing up. I'm just reading here from the literature, which the FII disseminated from the first day of the event. It is said, in the near term, our focus is sharply defined by several key areas: AI regulation and investment, tackling the ethical and financial implications of AI advancements, climate investment optimization, channeling funds into sustainable and impactful climate solutions, navigating the elections year in multiple countries, understanding the investment landscape in politically dynamic times, boosting investment flows to the global south, addressing economic disparities, and fostering growth and reframing the ESG rules, climate tech innovations, advancing technologies to combat climate change effectively. So what the FII has laid out here, these are things that I think lots of people are interested in or perhaps concerned about from many different points of view. But I would say that if there's one thing that stands out to me from this whole thing, and so much was packed into a 48-hour period, how that was done, even to me right now, sort of boggles the mind, but it indeed was done. I wonder if some sort of record was set. But the thing that stands out to me is the fact that, and this might sound a little cliche, but the world is changing. It's changing very rapidly. And I think I mentioned to Patrick before, but I certainly have mentioned this to others, that it's kind of strange, because if you take a picture of someone, I was actually thinking about this when the forum was in progress, when the summit was in progress, I was thinking that if you took a picture of the room, everyone in the room, it could just as easily have been 2009 in terms of how everyone was dressed, even though technology has changed since then. It's basically updates of the same thing, at least until AI came along, that's the spearhead of change now. But at the same time, so many issues have changed since 2009. So many ways of dealing with issues have changed, and they continue to change. The speed of change is unbelievable, even though the aesthetics of society, obviously reflected at the forum, are quite stable. So what we have now in this day and age is the illusion, in a way, the illusion of stagnancy, but the reality is that so much has changed economically, politically, socially, technologically, of course, in such a small period. It's really disorienting if you start to think about it at length. Anything to say about this stuff, Patrick?
To the speakers, regardless of the industry that they are working in, change is happening at such a rapid pace that be difficult for someone in any given industry to keep up, let alone the rest of us who are, you know, non-sector experts, you know, who are just trying to sort of hang on by the coattails of these more informed people. And so, as you say, Joseph, technology, you know, I think it's an accurate, understanding that in the 20th century, there was greater technological advancement in that one century than in all of previous human history up to 1900. And I would imagine that as we approach the end of the first quarter of the 21st century, the technological advancement is perhaps rapidly approaching another such momentous yardstick. And the question, when one of the many questions that begs, which this conference is a, really wasn't part of its remit, and in my sense, at least formally, didn't get a chance to really touch on, is how do we handle that, or can we handle that in terms of the non-technological, non-economic ramifications? I mean, there were a lot of good cases made for after explaining what the new technology was in sector X, how that could be applied and how that was going to improve things. But in terms of socially and culturally, what the consequences would be, not that these folks necessarily should be expected to know that or to want to delve into that. But I think for those of us, again, who aren't experts in sector X or sector Y or sector Z, those are fascinating questions because, as you're suggesting, Joseph, so much has happened, even though superficially not a lot has changed. So you might say aesthetically there's been little apparent change, but there's been massive change beneath the surface. And we know, I mean, definitely social media and the internet, the social cultural ramifications of the explosion of social media, the internet, the digital world, the virtual world, are obviously enormous. We're only just getting our arms around some of them, let alone all of them. And the ramifications and consequences, both positive and negative, are still being determined, at least to the extent that they actually impact our lives and how we go about them. So I think it's going to be fascinating, sort of 5-10 years from now, to figure out, to get an understanding of what many of these new technologies have done for us and done to us, right? I mean, there's a discussion about blockchain, discussions about all the electronically traded funds, discussion about AI, all these things. I mean, some of these things have been around for longer than others. We have a better grasp of them, but not necessarily a grasp of all the positive and negative consequences and all the ripples on the pond and all the unintended consequences, let alone AI. So it's very much to be determined, which you can view, I think, as maybe the majority of the speakers at this summit expressed with a certain amount of excitement, enthusiasm, optimism. But I think maybe for those of us who maybe don't have as much esoteric knowledge, there's a more of a tendency to be a little more apprehensive, a little more anxious. And given that we know from history, including contemporaneous history, that there are such negative and positive ripples on the pond. And it's not simply what the technology does to us as well as for us. It's what our institutions and our stakeholders and our most powerful and influential actors do with that technology, be they private sector or state actors, state-sponsored actors, right? So issues of censorship, freedom of information, for example, freedom of speech, are one of the, is a principal area of concern now, somewhat belatedly, out of the growth of technology and the improvements in technology. And so AI obviously is bringing up a whole host of issues. And there will be, it'll be interesting as the years go by, and I presume that there are more and more future investment initiatives summits and conferences, that how that discussion evolves, right? And whether folks retain their optimism. We have to hope they do, and it's well-grounded, because that means that AI on balance is helping us rather than hindering us. But, you know, to be determined, we will have to see.
To be determined is a very good way of putting it. AI is such an interesting thing because it makes so much so easy relative to what would have been done until virtually yesterday, in some cases literally yesterday. But there are so many issues associated with it. Privacy, avoiding defamation, this, that, the other thing. So it's really a... to say it's a sticky wicket, AI, is an understatement. What cannot be understated is the role that AI had at this summit, a massive, massive role. And I found many of the issues raised to be fascinating, as I'm sure you did. Patrick, generally speaking, how would you describe the, I wouldn't say attitude, because there are obviously different points of view, but how would you describe the sentiments and attitudes of speakers here towards, as you know, it's not just the AI issue, but more like the cornucopia of issues raised by AI.
Well, as an observation, I would say that the vast majority of speakers spoke of AI in terms of its positive potential. And again, to be fair, I don't imagine that most were asked to spend as much time on potential downsides and potential upsides, because after all, many of these folks, their companies are heavily invested. Maybe they themselves are doing research, academic research or private sector research. They are commissioning, funding, experiencing, executing elements of AI applications, and they were able to discuss, sometimes in quite a bit of detail, the positive journey that their company or their industry is on. And as I say, that's potentially very exciting. And they were certainly very, very enthusiastic about it. So there wasn't, in terms of what I was able to gather, not a great deal of discussion, not necessarily no detail on what might be the more likely downsides and what, if anything, could be done about it. So, I mean, just one example, and I apologize, I'm blanking on the name of the speaker, although he probably is glad that he's not named in this context. On the first day, this gentleman was talking about, explaining how much AI could change the workplace in terms of certain, say, occupations, but certain areas of staffing. And he was saying words to the effect that you think about all of the people we hire to think, to create, to be creative, to be thinking employees, etc. And he was stating, and it's again as a broad generalization, but he seemed quite sincere, that those roles at a lot of companies could, going forward, be filled by AI, right? And he may be correct that the goal is, and the probability is, that AI is going to do a chunk of the thinking and creating. But it sort of, to me hearing it, I immediately sort of thought of all of what I consider to be sort of the obvious downsides of that, and the how unlikely it was that that could be done truly successfully. And of course, at the same time, as these discussions are going on about the upsides of AI, which, you know, may all be valid, anyone who was looking on social media could see, and these were not tweets or postings that had anything to do with the conference, but because AI is such a, you know, such a popular topic, and just endless postings from folks who were detailing their latest horrendous experience with AI, right? Everyone from Elon Musk all the way down to us mere mortals, in all of the ridiculousness that nascent AI applications are spitting forth. So those ridiculous examples, instances of AI gone awry are real. But the gentleman speaking about the ability of AI to think and create for us may be just as real. He certainly knows a hell of a lot more about it than I do. But what is, I mean, in my inexpert way, my guess is that both, they are not mutually exclusive, right? If they don't already, they may well coexist going forward. And so if there is a path for true, or at least usable thinking and creating on the part of AI, then what are we going to do about all the stuff that doesn't work, right? And again, I'm saying this as someone who does not have the AI expertise of those, whether at this summit or in the media or elsewhere, who speak about it with great insight. But I think of it, the analogy that's always been with me since AI came to the fore has been the same, and it's been the same thinking I have about so many of, whether it's climate change models, public health models, you know, epidemiological models, or they can be statistical models used in survey research and polling, which is the outcomes, in the case of AI, the thinking and the creating, are only as good as the outputs, are only as good as the inputs. And I know I'm simplifying it and being very crude about, in terms of AI, an incredibly technically esoteric topic. But there will always be an element that is human influenced, even if with AI eventually it is a fraction of what it might be in a more conventional statistical model. But that human element is always going to be, I would guess, pivotal. So I would be fascinated to, going forward, whether it's at this type of an event or other events, to hear more about what the potential imperfections are in AI, and more importantly, what we can do, if anything, about that. And if we can't do much, in net terms, is it still worth it, or is it not? And of course, even if it's not, or it's a close call, as with most technological advancement, it's very hard to put the genie back in the bottles. So even if I was, you know, 100% anti-AI, I don't know how useful that position would be, because AI obviously isn't going away. So we need to know more about it, pro and con. If we're going to have to, we'll be living with it. Hopefully we'll be happily living with it. But if it's more of a mixed bag, then we need to know the black and the white of AI and the shades of gray.
I think the speakers who addressed AI here certainly can tell us about as much regarding the issue as one can expect any human being to, given some of the very, very impressive speakers who share their knowledge. But of course, even they, generally speaking, admitted that so much of AI is unknowable. Where things go from here definitely is a fork in the road, and that's a gross oversimplification. And any fork in the road is a complicated thing, so that it is an oversimplification lets you know how immensely difficult the subject matter is. And that's, you know, that's just difficult is putting it way too mildly, but it'll have to do for purposes of this conversation. Now, Patrick, I think that there is something really important about Miami, technically Miami Beach, being the site of this FII summit, because obviously the FII comes out of Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia has transformed itself into the country of the future. There are so many advances going on there in so many different regards that to get into them here would be a discussion in and of itself, a fascinating one, by the way. But Miami is seen to have parallels with the change sweeping Saudi Arabia, the vast economic improvement, and obviously the increase of prestige and power on the world stage. Any thoughts on the FII coming to Miami?
Yeah, well, as you know, Joseph,
foreign investment is one of the areas that I spend a fair bit of time on, and have worked on it in various parts of the world. And so I'm particularly interested in that element of this event and this type of event. And as you say, the Saudi Arabian story is a fascinating one. And it is fascinating that they have chosen to come to Miami. And I think I'm not privy to the institutes or the summits, internal thinking or working. So I'm just using guesswork from an external position. But my assumption is that what has been going on that's been largely positive in Saudi Arabia, which I'll sort of reflect on a little more detail in a moment, is a story which is worth telling in America, both because it, in a sort of mercenarial sense, instrumental sense, should hopefully on the part of the Saudi Arabians benefit that country, because there's a lot of reasons for Americans to invest in Saudi Arabia. But also, that's sort of, you might say, the selfish or self-interested part of it. I would also guess that the other reason that the Future Investment Initiative Summit is in Miami is also to help explain to Americans how they can do better, right? And Miami is one part of America that is something of an oasis when it comes to economic policy and financial matters. I mean, you know a lot more about this, certainly in more detail than I do, Joseph. But I think that's a fair statement. America is in very poor shape economically. And
I believe that Patrick, I just have to chime in. I don't want to sound rude, but I believe that Patrick is frozen. I see him there, but he froze and then his audio cut out, at least insofar as I can tell. I think I can hear him again.
I think I may be back.
I think so.
Let's see.
I'm back. I think I'm back. Just to continue, Joseph, if I may. One of the problems America has, big picture, is that she has gone. She's no longer a foreign investment mecca. She's no longer a magnet for foreign investment. And America, investors and capital are leaving America. Well, actually, not just leaving America, they're leaving Western countries, America, Canada, Western Europe especially. And there are a whole host of reasons for that I've written about and continue to write and talk about. We may or may not have time to get into some of that, Joseph. But this problem is a problem that that America has done to itself and the West is doing to itself. And so it's not a case of, well, America and the West are suffering bad luck, and whereas the Saudis are suffering, are experiencing good luck. And so there's nothing to learn. Nor is it the case that the likes of Miami and Florida are just fortunate. Like Saudi Arabia, they have lots of sand and sunshine and hot temperatures and aesthetically pleasing coastlines and beaches. And so God/Allah has smiled upon them. It's not that all of the above may or may not be true. But what is the case is that Saudi has instituted economic reforms that have completely transformed the external image of that country. And as a result, they're reaping the foreign investment benefits. America has done the opposite and is reaping the foreign investment downsides.
It is interesting,
to say the least, what has happened with Saudi Arabia and what's happening with America and the West. I think that it is something, how do I put it? It is something unique because, as Patrick said, it is self-inflicted. it is something self-inflicted, actually, both ways. Self-inflicted Saudi Arabia's economic reforms that make it such an attractive place for all kinds of investment. But the West making itself less competitive definitely is something self-inflicted, too. It's sort of, I think, indicative of the West in many ways losing confidence in its own abilities. And that goes far beyond economics, or perhaps becoming too comfortable, likely some combination of the two. And it's a very bad thing for those of us who are Westerners, who obviously want to see a very prosperous, bustling, fruitful Western civilization. And yet what we see all too often is the complete opposite. I was mentioning before to Patrick and some other people that, Miami Beach reminds me so much of a Manhattan, a midtown Manhattan during the late 1990s and the early 2000s, when you could walk around at dusk or at dawn, as I have done. I walked over a mile on both occasions, and you don't feel concerned. You're just walking through an urban environment. That's it. And there are no problems. It's a very pleasant thing. And you're surrounded, whether, you know, it's at twilight in the PM or AM, you're surrounded by things that are already bustling. People, businesses, obviously cars. It's nice. It definitely is nostalgic, but it's nostalgic in a way that propels things forward, because there's a productive model here that works, and it's showing what cities can be, and that the FII would come to a place like this is no surprise, because I do think that Miami, I'm speaking broadly here, city of Miami, Miami Beach, they represent sort of a vision for the future that is very much divorced from the pessimism, the sort of self-inflicted depression that so much of the West is going through, where there's hopelessness and people lashing out, as they often do when they don't feel they have much to live for. You definitely get a different vibe here. And so the FII coming here cannot be a surprise at all. If one's to think about positivity and moving forward in a substantive way, you're definitely going to get that nowadays in Miami. It is bustling. It is the city of the future. So the FII going to the city of the future, that's basically like a bee going to honey. It's completely natural. And Miami, not too long ago, and especially Miami Beach, they're going through a lot of the same problems now that places like Philly and Baltimore, where we are right now in mid-beach, in Miami Beach. It used to be terrible. It used to be a slum. South Beach, where I'm staying, was even worse. This was in the late 70s and 80s. But then there was urban renewal, and it's been basically turbocharged now, so that this has become a global hub. And that's another reason it reminds me of Midtown back in the day, Midtown Manhattan, because that was a global hub. It still is. But I would say that Manhattan is basically a legacy brand that's on the decline, that people still get because they're used to it, but it becomes more expensive and there are more lucrative alternatives like Miami Beach and Miami, the city itself. It's not surprising that people flock to this new thing and discard the old one. And that certainly explains the vast capital flight from the city of New York to Florida and to other places. I really do believe that we're going to see more of this as the years pass. I think that Miami is very well positioned to absorb a lot of the fleeing capital from New York and from other legacy brand places. And of course, soon enough, Miami, a beach and city, will become a legacy brand in and of themselves. I mean, people know about these places across the world, but they typically think about tourism or Latin American culture. They don't think about a tech hub. They don't think about a banking hub. They don't think about these things that these places are trying very hard to become and that they are becoming. So it's really interesting. This, when you're here, you are well positioned for the future because, you know, as the saying goes, the future is now. And you just can't help but see it. Just walking around here, you cannot help but see how impressive it is. All of the commerce, all of the capital. And obviously, this is a place that is going places. Patrick, anything to say about the litany of things that I just brought up?
To pick up on what you were talking about, vibe and all of that, Joseph, because it really is a part of this. I mean, there's the economic policy part of it. I would say there's the political governance part of it. By that, I mean, if you have, as you have in America, a situation where lawfare, politicized use of the legal and judicial systems against political opponents and alleged opponents or perceived opponents in the private sector. If you have that situation, not only are you dealing obviously with a banana republic type situation, but it's one that, looking just at the investment side of things, is one that is going to drive investor away. One of the reasons investment is fleeing America and fleeing the West is because of the sanctions on Russia. Not simply the fact that sanctions were put on Russia, but the fact that Western governments' banks were so willing and found it so easy to simply freeze assets, take assets, make it impossible, not just for the Russian government, but for Russian business, Russian individuals to operate, having to, in many cases, sort of give up their assets, flee from them, etc. Now, whatever the morality, the ethical side, the geopolitical nature of all of these decisions, the bottom line in an investment, on investment metric, is that that is not an environment that is going to keep investors around, right? They like political stability. They like to know that there is a legal system and it's going to, that will be applied, and it will be applied equitably, across the board. That is no longer the case in America. It's no longer a case in much of the West. So you have capital flight from New York to other parts of America, Florida being the best example. And you have capital flight from America, period, most of it beyond the West. So that's the political governance side element that goes along, supplements the economic financial one. But another one that's really important that doesn't get enough attention, that I try to stress to folks when talking about foreign investment, is the social cultural one. And this is where you're getting at, what you're getting at, Joseph, with your comments about Vine. New York City is, has gone downhill in terms of quality of living quite rapidly. Obviously things improved tremendously from the mid 90s for a decade or so. It's amazing how quickly things can go back to the bad old days of the 70s and 80s, as they have done in New York. Washington, D.C. Is virtually unlivable at this point, right? The violence, the violent crime, the murders, the carjackings, the inability and unwillingness of local and state politicians in the nation's capital and in the northeast of this country to restore law and order is staggering, frightening, unnerving. And its bottom line implication is that people don't want to live there anymore. They can't operate their businesses there. And so their business and their capital go elsewhere. And across America, not all of America, as you say, Florida, Miami area, you can literally feel the difference within minutes of getting off the plane. I mean, it's remarkable. You feel like you're in a different country. It is so different to much of the Northeast, in my experience, and I think of the experience of others, right? You go to broken Britain, as it's described these days, and London is still a large, important center, but it's not a particularly enjoyable center. It's not a fun place for most people to live anymore. Crime, economic problems, etc. The massive problems throughout the West, obviously, of illegal immigration, migrant immigration, asylum seekers, all of that has obviously been mishandled, to put it very gently. And so for all these reasons, there are a great number of investors and business owners and a greater volume of capital that for non-direct economic reasons, but heavily for social quality of life reasons, looking to go elsewhere. And one of the places they have decided upon, at least in the short term, and I suspect in the medium to long term as well, is a country such as Saudi Arabia. And if you spend any time there, it is a dynamic culture, right? It has become a risk-taking culture, which is something that couldn't be said of Saudi Arabia or much of the Arab world until fairly recently. But Saudi Arabia, along with most of the other Gulf states, as they decided quite formally and quite energetically to diversify their economies away from oil, that they have become more transparent, more outward looking. They are much more sort of Western oriented economically and otherwise than they were. And they are reaping the rewards. You know, when there's no income tax and there's a very low flat rate of corporate tax, and the legal system and the political system is stable and doesn't play political favorites the way that happens in so many Western countries these days. And there's a tremendous work ethic, truly educated labor force, and just a vibrancy. You talk about the vibrancy here in Miami, Joseph. There's a vibrancy, a dynamism, an optimism. This is something you find in some major Asian cities as well, but is sorely lacking in much of Western Europe and much of North America these days. And so you have investors. They're relocating their capital. In many cases, they're relocating their actual headquarters for their corporations or their businesses. And in quite a number of cases, they're actually relocating themselves and their families. They're deciding that there's a quality of life in Saudi Arabia which they can no longer experience or guarantee here in North America or, let's say, in Western Europe. So this is fascinating stuff, interesting stuff, but it's also, I mean, initially it's quite depressing, right? Because it's a little bit like the brain drain from the United Kingdom in the post-war period to North America and Australia and other parts, which is a serious hit to the UK in economic terms, in academic terms, and cultural terms. And there's something that there's a capital drain, and with it a certain amount of a brain drain to the Gulf states, particularly to Saudi Arabia right now. But of course, there are always lessons to be learned, and we sort of outlined some of them, Joseph, you know, here in our conversation. Saudi Arabia has repositioned itself, consciously decided to apply sort of a free market economic model, a light regulatory touch, a sane fiscal policy, et cetera, more transparent, better governance system. You know, in North America and in Western Europe, we've gone in completely the opposite direction across all those fronts and allowed, in some cases, actually encouraged crime to run riot, literally and figuratively, in our streets. So we can learn the lessons of our mistakes, but the irony is that in 2024, the United States of America may not be, but she should be, looking at a country like Saudi Arabia and saying to herself, what can I do to make myself more like her, right? Now, I think that's the rational response in 2024 for the United States of America vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia. But the notion, even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, before these reforms started in Saudi and the Gulf states, I mean, it's unimaginable. And 20 or 30 years ago, I would have been, you know, put in an asylum. Now, some people would like me in an asylum now, but perhaps for other reasons. But, you know, so this is where we are, but that's the reality. And an event like the Future Investment Initiative Summit here in Miami, the annual conference in Riyadh, the other regional summits, I mean, there's the next one's coming up in Brazil later in the year. FII is going to have a summit in Africa. You know, the notion that more and more of the world is going to be exposed both to the opportunities that Saudi Arabia presents, but also, I think more importantly, the mindset that the Saudis and others have been able to sort of percolate in their own societies. And that used to be part of the American and European DNA that entrepreneurial spirit, that can-do attitude, that willingness to take risk, right? That tolerance of risk. We've lost that not only in an economic and financial sense where we're all about crony capitalism, right? We're all about gaming the system so that we have a, because we have a political advantage, that we can make our money, right? Rather than provide greater value for the consumer and reap rewards that way, right? So we have lost our way, but hopefully as more and more people become aware of the value of this type of an event, and as I say, more importantly, the sense of utility that there still exists in us as economic actors, financial actors, technological actors, that there is, that does give me a certain amount of optimism. But of course, this, you know, these are hard yards because we have so lost our way in the West, across the West, economically, socially, culturally, etc., that these changes which we are self-inflicted, these negative consequences we're living with now, they did not happen overnight, although some of them appear to have sprung up overnight because they were so carefully and so cleverly hidden for so long. So that means that the reforms that I think we should make, the kind of reforms that they have initiated and instituted in Saudi Arabia over the last several years, they will not come easily to us. But the good news is, as the Saudis are experiencing, and as every jurisdiction experiences when they, for example, get their fiscal house in order, reform their tax policy, etc., is the positive changes are experienced quite quickly. Because as I've been discussing, capital, when it's allowed to, will move around very quickly. It won't stagnate. It will find the best environment, the most fertile, profitable environment. And that is why it is fleeing America, most of America, so quickly these days, fleeing the West. But it can and will return if we get our house in order. That, of course, to use my phrase of our conversations, Joseph, is to be determined.
You know, I mean, there's so much to get into here. It's
really interesting. I often say things are really interesting, and I really mean it. But this is especially interesting because it's an existential question of how heretofore prosperous, bustling places will handle themselves, and that's going to have immense repercussions not only for the local economies of these places, but for the economy of America and other countries that are dependent upon America. People can probably hear in the background all sorts of sounds and such, and it's because we're here on Collins Avenue. That's the main drag in Miami Beach, for those who don't know, and it's sort of similar to perhaps Fifth Avenue in New York City. That's I think might be a good, in Manhattan, that might be a good way of putting this. And there's just so much going on. There really is so much going on. You see it just sitting in the room, the stuff happening all around you outside. And it's reflective of a place whose leaders decided that they were going to do something and seriously pursue their plan. Now, other cities can do this. As I said, Miami Beach used to be in a terrible way. People would leave here to go to New York for opportunity. But now it's the opposite. And whether or not New York, Philly, Baltimore, all these other lovely places will turn themselves around, I mean, that's one massive question. It's not looking like the question has a positive answer at this point, but, you know, hope springs eternal. Patrick, why do you think there seems to be a total lack of appetite in these failing cities, in what Kevin O'Leary might call loser states? Why do you think there's such a lack of appetite in these failing cities to make themselves competitive with Miami Beach, Miami, Riyadh, and other places such as those in Asia? It seems like a lot of politicians and even some business leaders from these legacy brand cities, I'm talking about the failing ones, obviously not the successful ones I just brought up, it seems like a lot of them are going, oh, well, so what? You definitely get that impression from the so-called leadership class in New York City and in New York State, which is basically powered by New York City. And a lot of the business leaders in New York are either just trying to put up with it or they're coming to Florida. So why do you think there is this sort of lack of interest in these failing legacy brand places for betterment? Because the incentive for change is obvious to remain competitive, to be a place people want to move to, a place people want to spend money in, a place people are going to pay tax revenue in. But, you know, a lot of people, powerful people in these legacy brand cities just seem to look at what's happening here on Collins Avenue and shrug or maybe even scoff or thumb their noses. It's bizarre, to say the least.
Yeah. To it, Joseph. You know, I would put you and your audience to sleep if I was to start going through all of them. But I mean, to touch on one, for example, I would use the analogy of when I'm asked by more rational non-Brits, why is it that the British people put up with the National Health Service, right? Now, there's an argument for the National Health Service, which remains overwhelmingly popular in the UK. I don't think it's a convincing one, but you have to recognize the political reality. And so the question is valid. You know, the elements of the question are valid. Most Brits support the National Health Service, and even conservatives always pride themselves on stressing how their economic policy will, you know, fund the National Health Service even better. Where during the whole public rationale for all the COVID lockdowns in the UK was to save the National Health Service, as opposed to save the British people. But that's a discussion for another day, or was a discussion in a past day. But my point is that in my answer to the NHS question, is it is also multifaceted, but the main line of answering is that most Brits don't realize there's an alternative, right? So they think it's either everyone dying at a young age because of lack of medical care or the National Health Service. And while they hate the queuing and they know the rationing is bad and incredible numbers of Brits die unnecessarily because they don't receive treatment in time and all these kinds of things, it isn't as technologically advanced as the American system, et cetera, et cetera. They don't think there is a viable alternative. And their notion of alternatives, principally the American system, it's the same thing in Canada with the Medicare system. Anyone who suggests there's, you know, something should really be done, root and branch reform of the system, is immediately thrown in your face. Is, yeah, but then the American system, you know, everybody just dies. No one can, only the rich can afford medical care and all that kind of stuff. So there's this straw man argument made. And I think if you're looking at these terribly run cities and states in America, which aren't exclusively in the northern states, but disproportionately in the Northeast, also I'd throw in at least a couple of West Coast states in there as well. I think in part, it's because many folks don't think there's an alternative. You have to recognize that many of these cities and states have been run by either the same people or the same party, the same, to be very generous to them, the same ideas for a very long time. There's been such control, the educational system, the media, everyone is, the differences are of degree, not kind, in terms of the information that's provided, right? So there's very little political competition, there's very little competition among ideas, right? And where folks are frustrated, which is real, they feel stuck. They don't feel there's any change that can happen. This is just the way it is, right? And of course, this is a wonderful thing, self-reinforcing prophecy. No one pushes for change, so change doesn't happen, whether it's the NHS or whether it's these urban centers in America. And of course, you also have people vote with their feet. So whether it's because of taxes or crime, various quality of life issues, terrible public schools, that is, in an American context, government-run schools, you have increasingly people are leaving. So in California for several years now, I think the first year was 2020, when more people left California than moved to California. And that has accelerated. That's why the the cost of renting a U-Haul to move your family, your goods from California to Texas is twice what it is from Texas to California, because there's twice as much business in going east rather than going west. Now, you have to commend people for starting their lives over somewhere else where they have a better chance at a better life for themselves and for their families. But what that means in a political sense is that those folks tend to take their value, they do take their values, they tend to take their voting habits with them. So whereas in the 90s, first decade of this century, you had liberal Democrats leaving California, the best example, because they couldn't take it anymore, and then moving to the likes of Texas and Colorado and Utah and turning those states less red and more blue than they were previously, in some cases overwhelmingly so, perversely, perhaps counterintuitively, fleeing what was wrong, but then voting for more of it where they went. That continues to affect elections at all levels in America, including the presidential. But what's happening now in recent years is you have states like Texas, and Florida is the best example. You have conservative Republican voting Americans leaving Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and New York and New Jersey, and they're going to the likes of Florida and other states, which tend to be red states to begin with, and they're turning them from mildly red to deep red. And that's certainly the trajectory that those states are on, which if you're in Florida, for example, and you're of a red hue yourself, is a great thing. The problem is that means there are fewer rational voters in the states that they've left. So the pool of people who are affected by this terrible governance in many states and municipalities in America is growing, who are impacted by it, affected by it, who are frustrated, who are economically dislocated, who are victims of crime, et cetera, whose kids are getting terrible educations. But the pool of people who are going to take the next logical step and vote accordingly, that is, vote for something different, that is, in proportionate terms, that is declining. So that makes it even less likely that change is going to come about. So, and what you get in New York City, you get it in the state of Maryland, you get other parts of the Northeast, New Jersey, where you'll get a mayor or a governor who will be comparatively sane for a term or two, and then they're term limited or they retire, whatever, and they're immediately replaced by just the type of politician who they replaced in a wave of frustration and anger 4 or 8 years previously, and the cycle repeats itself. And so it's very hard to see how these places actually change enough. And I think it just really locks in, cements the fact that America is divided more and more, deeper and deeper divisions as we go through this process culturally, economically, and consequently politically, where there are fewer and fewer municipalities, towns, cities, counties, states that are truly up for grabs on a regular, even on an occasional basis. It's just simply the reality. It's very frustrating and potentially quite depressing to think that change will come about. Because the counter argument to what I'm saying is that with any social or cultural political phenomenon, if things get bad enough, they will reach a tipping point and a critical mass will revolt. I mean, New York did politically turn itself around in the 1990s. It does happen from time to time in the most unexpected places. But it usually has to be pretty, pretty darn bad for that to happen. And now, as I say, Washington, D.C. is practically unlivable. Much of Maryland is getting that way. Much of Northern Virginia is getting that way. New York City's that way. Is it at the tipping point? Are we there? Perhaps. but it doesn't appear that we're there quite yet. We're there at the point where people will leave if they can, but those who stay either by choice or because they have no option, will they actually make a change? I mean, will, you know, what happened in the most recent election in Chicago, suffering the most terrible crime statistics imaginable, and the mayor was defeated in the Democratic primary. Now, people on the, you know, most outside observers think, oh, that's amazing, that's great. You know, she failed miserably, and her, even her party recognized that. But who did they nominate, and therefore, who was the de facto new mayor, is the new mayor? Someone even worse than her, someone who viewed her as too moderate. And this happens again and again, where a failed politician is replaced by some, in these sort of de facto one party towns, cities, states, replaced by their party, replaces them by someone who's even more of a true believer. And the minority politically have to suffer that much worse as a consequence.
It is
something else, to say the absolute least. It's really awful, depressing, but I mean, it is what it is. What are you going to do? Patrick, as we unfortunately do wrap things up here, we've already gone a bit over time, but that's perfectly fine considering the worthwhile stuff we've been discussing. What do you think will come of perhaps the FII having more of a role on the world stage in terms of being this organization that has events that bring a prominent business and economic thinkers together to discuss key events? Obviously, the World Economic Forum has traditionally fulfilled this role, and the FII doesn't see itself as, you know, a competitor to the World Economic Forum. The FII, from all I've understood, sees itself basically as doing its own thing and obviously doing that very well. So where do you think the FII goes from here in terms of world economic events?
I think the FII goes from strength. I mean, it's partly about the content, in the sense, you know, I could sort of wax or attempt to wax lyrical about the great ideas that are put forward, the sort of the point of view, the perspective of the Institute, and more importantly, of many of the speakers who come forward. I think there already are, and there will be many very helpful, pragmatic, bottom line prescriptions, you know, implementable, executable. I think this is one of the real strengths of the FII events, is that they're very real world. They're very grounded in a way that the World Economic Forum and many globalist multilateral institutions and events, you know, simply aren't. So that's really important. And I think that the FII events will continue to have legs. They'll get from strength to strength because of that, because people will see the realism and the practicality of what is being discussed and what is being proposed. Because but I think more importantly, and where the greater influence comes, is in the nature and the tone of these events, right? Because as I've touched on already, there's an accessibility to the FII events. There's an interactive quality. It might sound counterintuitive, given who the origins of the FII events, the location of the global conference, and who the speakers are, and who some of the delegates are. But there's an egalitarian quality to the FII events that I don't think exists in any of the peer events out there. In fact, not even close. I say everybody has a voice. Everybody has a figurative seat at the table. It's a collegial environment. It's a collaborative environment. It's an incubator, I would say, an incubator of ideas, right? It's about how do we not come up with collectivist solutions, but how do we collectively refine our solutions, our prescriptions? How do we take these brilliant ideas that a private sector or an academic researcher, some tech expert has sort of brought forth through their intellect and their creativity. And how do we give that real world application? And this, I say it's not a theme of the events, but it's an sort of an underlying theme, I think, of the spirit of all of these events, which is that making money is a good thing, right? It's what you do with the money that can have negative consequences. And it's what government does to those who make money that can have negative consequences. So let's celebrate entrepreneurship. Let's celebrate risk-taking. Let's celebrate innovation. Let's celebrate creativity, right? Let's celebrate advancing ourselves as a society. But to do that, we need to be smart. We need to learn from history. We need to work together on better applications of our knowledge. And so I think in tone, in prescription, it's just a very, very refreshing approach. And one that, you know, I just don't see that there's a ceiling on it, because both because it has value on its own, but also, I mean, we're talking about a bit, we're talking about a business which is based, one hopes, on a competitive environment, a competitive marketplace. The marketplace is not crowded with future investment initiative type events, right? It's not. It's there's crony capitalist events, and there's single industry events, and then you've got all your Davos type stuff. So the FII events have carved out a niche for themselves, but niche is actually doing them an injustice. 7 years in, you know, that they've, I think, really created a market, their own market, and there's a, they're supplying something that the market was missing. There's obviously tremendous demand going from strength to strength, and I think this is going to increase, and good luck to them, because, you know, they're adding value to the public debate, and for those of us in the kind of work that you and I do, Joseph, you know, that's really important, and most welcome.
Indeed, it is. That's to say the least.
I really have been impressed, as I've been saying, by what I've seen here. It's the amount of knowledge shared has been absolutely incredible, and I think that there will be there definitely will be a great cause for more FII summits across the world. There's just so much going on. It's really something else and then some. So it really has been an experience, an informative experience, to get all this information from so many different perspectives, and to have that to have that information come to you at a time of such rapid change as you and I were discussing before. That is about all for this chat. Although there is, I think, one follow-up question that's worthwhile. In a single word, how would you describe the summit, Patrick? I think my word is obvious, impressive. What would your word be?
Enlightening.
That is a good way of putting it. That really is. I think that as the future comes to us, well, the future is now, and I should say, as the future progresses, we're going to see a lot more made out of FII events. I think the Institute is definitely going to have a louder say in terms of world economic phenomena. And it is good to see new voices, or, you know, in the case of the FII, it's been around for a few years now, newer voices. It's good to see newer voices bring something else to the table, because heaven knows the table has been getting pretty boring and counterproductive, not just unproductive, but counterproductive. Patrick, any parting words?
Well, it's been a pleasure to be at another FII event. And hopefully, if we're both fortunate, if the gods shine on us, Joseph, you and I shall meet again at a future such event.
I very much would be
glad to attend any other FII event. I mean, the knowledge is it's incredible. It really is. It gives you so much to think about. And I'm the sort of guy who's always thinking about things, keeping me up at night, getting me, in some cases, no sleep at all. But it's good to be kept up by something that is relevant, not just, you know, some irrational fear. Certainly concerns about the global economy are not irrational. We live in a time of great unease and discontent. So, what the future holds, big question, but it's good to see some optimism on the horizon. There definitely was a great deal of that at this FII. Patrick, once again, thank you very much for being here. It's great to, we've been meeting for years now virtually, but finally got to meet in person. I posted the picture of that on Twitter, and this whole event, to say the least, has been impressive. I don't want to stress the word, but impressive is it, although Patrick's description of it as being enlightening certainly makes a great deal of sense. Everyone, I trust you have found this conversation to be as worthwhile as Patrick and I have. We barely scratched the surface about what happened here at FII. Arguably, we didn't even scratch the surface at all. There's too much to get into, but really fascinating stuff. So much to chew over. And it's always good when diverse ideas are put out there so people can have as informed an opinion as possible about the events that impact them. And holy Moses, are there a lot of events impacting a lot of people right now? And no doubt that shall continue to be the case. We do live, as the Chinese would say, in interesting times. After all, any parting words, Patrick?
Well, it is interesting times, but it gives one. I would say that I leave this event in Miami Beach thinking of the glass slight, maybe not half full, but slightly less half empty than I did when I arrived a couple of days ago.
Well, that is good
to hear. It really is. Patrick, obviously, thank you very much for being here. And I'm certainly glad to have had this discussion. There's going to be someone else on, a very distinguished guest, but unfortunately there was a Wi-Fi issue, so I believe I'll be speaking with him next week. That will be another interesting chat about the FII and issues that are important to it. So anyway, folks, I hope you've had a great day. I hope you found this conversation to be worth your while. Be sure to tune in for the next one and all subsequent chats. Stay safe, be well, and I don't have a full bottle, but it's actually empty. But I raise it anyway. Stay safe, be well, and cheers.